This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Hey gang, welcome to Indie Comic Book Noise episode 342. Can you believe it's been that many episodes? Yeah, how about that, guys? Give yourselves a pat on the back. I'm Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker along with the usual gang, Andrew, Kevin, and Phil.
Hello.
Yo.
Thanks for listening.
And we're the podcast that's sponsored by nobody. When we're not doing Marvel Noise, we get together here under low-hanging lights and otherwise dark room and discuss the indie comic books we've been reading.
Thanks for making us sound creepy, Steve.
Not that creepy. We got a Facebook page. We're all on Twitter.
But we're not stalking Kitty Pryde or anything, so that's all good.
Andrew, you recently dove in and checked out one of the creators that I have been raving about since I just discovered him recently, and read something that I hadn't read but did have. So then when you said you were reading it, I went ahead and read it, and I pretty much enjoyed it. And you've been curiously silent about your opinion, and I'm very curious to know what you thought of Richard Sala's Grave Robber's Daughter.
I had the $5 credit left over from that Comixology gifted everybody, and my Twitter feed kindly reminded me that it was expiring. So I jumped on, and for $4.99, I picked up Grave Robber's Daughter, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, I got to say, I would much rather have had this in paper. I don't really like reading comics on Comixology. I mean, it's when I have to do it, I do. But I really had a fun time. It's our main character is Judy Drood.
Yeah, it's Judy Drood. She's a recurring character in Sala's universe of stories. The name, it's got to be like Nancy Drew and maybe yeah. Judy Blume, like the child, the kid's author.
But I just... She's super foul-mouthed.
Yeah, and she's not afraid to throw a punch, even though she's otherwise looks just like a typical, victim type,
So I just really like that she's just like every other... Then she's like, fuck that. So there's something about her sort of just putting it out on Front Street. But yeah, like you say, she totally kicks ass. This doesn't make any sense at all for me, but for some reason... It just kind of reminded me of something like a modern Ditko tale, kind of.
Yeah.
Not that he ever had women, but that kind of very quirky, eccentric characters.
Yeah, the horror is more of a creepy tension. It's compelling. There's that, Sala has that touch of, we see it on every book, of that whimsical aspect to what's going on. It never gets too intense, yet... there's bodies being punctured with sharp objects all over the place. I really like the atmosphere he gives his books. This one's from 2006, and it's all black and white. I really, really like his color work, 10 times even more. 96 pages, so you get the story all together. And it's this creepy place, Obadiah's Glen. There's no people. There's a creepy carnival, punk kids, creepy demon clowns, and then a really creepy little girl who ends up being her ally, who's the grave robber's daughter. I really like his stuff, and this is very classic of his type of tale. And you're right, Andrew, the physical copy of his collected editions are this, in the black and white, there's no glaze on the pages at all, and they're really heavy stock pages, and so they really hold thick in your hand, and again, without it being that glossy reflective stuff, it just really feels like a piece of print.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna maybe track down the paper versions. I like the black and white a lot in this one. I mean, you've turned me on to his web comic, which is in color, that I've been following. Well, that I read a whole bunch of, and I'm waiting for it to build up to read the next batch of.
Same here.
And I like that a lot, but I'm glad this one was black and white. I think it suits the storytelling, but I'll check out more because I like Judy Drood, the main character, and if she's a recurring, because it starts with her getting off of some adventure that they allude to, which I'm sure was some earlier tale.
Yes.
But she's like a super foul-mouthed Nancy Drew who just kicks ass.
Because of that boldness, she's, you know, doesn't mind just walking right into potentially dangerous situations, and that, like, moves the story right along. And if, like, a bad guy grabs her, she's going to, like, poke him in the eye, you know? And it just moves right through the elements, and she gets to the end of the, to use, like, a video game metaphor, she gets to the end of the level. And that's what the stories are like. She's not in every one of his tales. He's got a couple of different recurring characters, all female-oriented. But good stuff. Glad you liked it.
And it really flows well. Like, you're right. It's a real kind of page. I mean, you can stop and look at what's on the page, but the story also clips. I think having that whimsical nature helps, too, because if he ever gets in a corner, he can just move her boldness and the whimsy factor can just move the story at any point. If it's ever lingering or whatever, he's just going to introduce the next element in it, and it fits without feeling forced.
Cool. What's going on north of the border?
Well, I swear everything I've been reading, I've been loving so much. I got, I know Andrew wasn't excited for this one, but Nailbiters.
That cover was outrageously...
Oh, it's my new cover of the year.
Oh, my God.
Really?
It was disturbing as heck.
I love it. It's just a guy biting on his fingers, chewing right through them.
Down to the bone.
Yeah, which is kind of like the name Nailbiter. This is by a story by Joshua Williamson and art by Mike Henderson. There's two issues out right now. And the first issue has a great wraparound cover. It's him biting his nails on the front, and then the back is like a kind of like a little blurb about what the comic's about and stuff. It's pretty nice. And basically what it is like the reason why Andrew wasn't excited, and I'm not big on them either, is serial killer stories. It's definitely not my cup of tea. But this one is really cool. It has a bit more of a, like, they have more of a slasher feel almost. Like, not that they're supernatural, but they have a gimmick maybe or something about them. And basically what it is there's this guy who's, I forget if he's a reporter or a profiler, but he's investigating in this town because this one town somehow birthed 16 of the nastiest serial killers ever. Like one guy that like just burns people alive in their houses, or the nail biter guy that what he does is he'll chew their nails off. Then when they grow back, he'll eat their fingers down to the bone until they die. Basically, that's his thing.
That's a weird get up for.
Yeah, it creates some. Really
Ooh, hand
images.
That comic over here.
Yeah. Just what I've been waiting for. I've just been waiting for them to get to that specific thing.
The thing is, though, like, the cover, yeah, is gory, but the inside, you don't really get any of that. Like, a lot of the killing's off camera kind of thing.
Off
like
camera on the cover.
Yeah. Like, so, it's not gory at all. And, yeah, so basically the profiler guy's there investigating, and he calls his friend, and he's like, you got to come meet me in this town. You're the only one I trust. I need to tell you something. So he goes to meet his friend, this other guy, but he's missing. So now it's him trying to figure out what happened to his friend, and all this freaky, crazy stuff starts happening. And the guy who bites his fingers, they went to him for help. So, because somehow he got off. He's the one killer that got off, and now he's living back in the town at his home and everything. Like, it's really creepy. And so I have a feeling he'll be helping them here and there kind of thing. But it's a must-get for me. I think I don't like these type of stories at all, but I'm really enjoying this a lot. Or maybe fans of Hack Slash would like it. Not that it's really anything like that, but it's kind of the same themes, I guess, in a way.
Speaking of gory covers.
Oh, yeah. What?
Are you aware of the Chew Revival crossover?
Oh, I haven't read that yet, but I imagine that's going to be good.
Because it, the other cover is pretty, well, I don't know, I should say pretty normal. I guess comparatively normal when someone's serving a gun and then you have a heart in front of you. Because that's the more realistic cover. And then you have the Chew cover, which is him getting served his boss's head on a plate. And then there's someone else's head in the bowl and there's, like, blood spurting out. So I was just thinking, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of, you know, getting a little graphic. But when you have the cartoony stuff, it's like, I don't know, it's kind of easier to digest.
Mm-hmm. See, I can't read that yet because I haven't read Revival yet at all.
Yeah, I would say that's probably a wise thing because it seems like the Revival story like spoils one of the secrets of the series. Like, it seems like since they brought someone else from another series, like Tony Chu, into it, and he has abilities, he can like observe or see things going on in their world that no one in their world would be able to figure out. Like, you could have been able to put the pieces together, I think, but it seems weird that that would be the thing that would cause something to happen in the Revival world, unless they're not going to, like, run with that. Like, if these type of things are like, oh, they cross over, but they don't affect their continuities. But it seems weird that you would reveal something like that in a story like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I enjoyed the Chu side better, though. But there's a lot of good interactions on both sides. It's just the, like, what, like, Chu is in the Revival story, but his partner isn't because he has the whole like weird, messed up cyborg face type of thing. So I guess they're like, well, that's how are they going to fit that into like a more realistic story?
Yeah.
But the Chu side is a lot of fun because the characters are interacting and goofing around and joking, and then you have all these weird occurrences that you see. Maybe I'm just, I don't know, more into the Chu story. And you know, when you start putting all these body parts together and the body wakes up after you've reassembled it, like some kind of weird Frankenstein type of thing. Like, I guess that just worked for me a lot better. And there's just, like, a lot of in-jokes to, like, what's going on. Like, since Tony eats things and then he can get a read off of them, well, like, when the characters from Revival is pointing things out, like, oh, but this thing you're eating isn't food and you got a reading off of that. How does that work? And it's just like, oh, yeah. So I think it's kind of clever in that respect. And it ends, like, a bit predictably. Because maybe it's not so predictably if, like, I guess what it is. But it's something that's been going on through the whole series, but still a fun read. So I'd be totally game if they crossed over more, like, image titles like this just for fun.
Well,
because
another
weird
crossover coming out is Gru versus Conan.
Yay.
Yeah.
Those crossovers are always so fun. I was catching up on, we just discovered Noble Causes, so I was reading the trades.
Mm.
Yeah, like, it's fun to see, like, Invincible and Savage Dragon. And they just show up for, like, a couple, you know, an issue.
Well, actually, they had their own super team, the kids, Invincible, Fire Dragon or whatever his name was, by Hester.
Right.
The girl from Noble Causes, they had a team called The Pact. It was a four-issue miniseries. So that's why they cross over a lot.
Yeah, that was in Invincible continuity, so that's kind of interesting.
But it's still, even reading the series, I didn't read it when it was coming out, I'm reading it now, it still kind of holds up. It's just this fun little...
Well, it's awesome.
The old Marvel, you know, where just someone's going to pop in for an issue or two and then
there's some great
again.
There's some great shocks, and it all ties in great. Like, you have to read everything.
Lately, it seems we've been, at least I've been seeing on the forums, we have our forum over as part of the Comic Book Noise network of forums on the 11 o'clock comics forum, and seeing grumblings here and there and a lot of comments from people that they have cut down on the number of Kickstarter projects that they've supported over the last year as compared to previous years, and had some things that weren't fulfilled or weren't quite keeping them as anxious to find the next project to back. And I got to say that I just got a Kickstarter reward recently that I enjoyed quite a bit and wanted to pass it along to you guys because it'll come on on sale to the general public coming soon, given the information on the website that I'll give to you shortly. And that is the digital version. And I honestly wish that I had gotten... It's so hard to know when you're doing one of these Kickstarters and it's creators you might not be familiar with or a concept that seems cool, so you want to at least check it out, but you don't know if it needs to be the beautiful hardcover on your shelf. This is one that would have been nice to have as the hardcover, I've got to say. And that is the World War Kaiju. Did you guys hear about
that
this
one
at all?
As well. I got my digital copy and backed it. I don't remember what level I backed it at, so I don't know if I'm... getting anything more coming my way, or it's just the digital. I've sadly backed, I think, over 140 sales.
Wow.
I've way cut back on backing
that LA money.
Well, you would have to cut back from that number. There's only one way to go from that number, so don't feel bad.
I've just been, like you say, there's been a lot of there's a lot of awesome stuff, but you know, it really is kind of gambling. But I also did get the World War Kaiju digital as well.
Our benefactor, Derek Howard, the grand poobah of the Comic Book Noise Network, also appeared to be a contributor, and he got his name in the book. From Outer Space. Derek from Outer Space. The book is cool. It's a mix of sequential comic art in a painterly style, I'll say, and also text sections with, like, spot illustrations and little strips and things on a third of the page. The hook here is that, you know, other than having Kaiju in its name, which is somewhat all of the hook it needs, this is an alternate reality where instead of the Allies during World War II winning the war by developing the bomb, they do so by developing a Kaiju and get the same results, right? The tromping through the cities and, you know, the cities in Japan are wiped out and the same result happens. But this is going to change what the Cold War looks like, right, Andrew?
Yes, and I just looked it up. And I am getting the actual physical copy of the book.
Nice.
Sweet. Right.
What we end up with is a Cold War where, like, every country, major nation, develops their own Kaiju with mixed results. One I'll mention because I think it's very clever and introduced earlier in the book. I don't want to give too much away, but the Russia's initial Kaiju is the Red Armadillo, and he's like all propaganda and symbolism over substance. He's only painted red. And he's got like extra spines that are shown like riveted to his back to make him look like he's more fearsome. And they have the U.S. try to breed their Kaiju, which is like a Godzilla analog, nicknamed the Fat Man, you know, as per the bomb code word. And they tried to breed the Fat Man, and they end up with a Godzuki-like little disaster that they just want to shuffle aside, you know, with a face that's totally Godzuki. It's hilarious. And there's all callbacks to the monsters that we know and familiar with. There's like a Mothra equivalent, and they've got the two little tiny twin princesses, and the word bubbles are colored for them. Then you can totally imagine their little stereo voices together, you know, giving their dialogue just like in the movies. I loved it.
I did read some of it. I didn't finish it because I was waiting for the hard copy, but I just flipped through it to look at the art and everything. But I generally tend to wait on those things to get the full package. But I like to check that I have the digital in case something happens and I know, oh, at least I have the digital if there's any kind of problem or whatever. I've got something. But also, you can't be too much in a hurry. You know, these things take what they take.
The idea, too, the way the story is told, it's kind of like a Bob Woodward-type character, looks like Redford, who's collecting information about the history of the Kaiju through interview. So some of it is, you know, the sequential art of them talking to somebody or sequential art showing, you know, the action sequences of what the general and is describing to the interviewer, that kind of thing. Or there's actual, like I said, text pages where it'll actually be in kind of interview form where they can get a lot of information across. And I thought that might break up the story a little awkwardly, but it really doesn't, which is cool. And it's on black page with white text, and sometimes that can be uncomfortable, and really read just fine, especially on the digital version that I was looking at when light is shining through the back of it. But there's a lot of fun little clever nods in there, and they do explain like the whole origins of their world, setting it up of how the Kaiju are formed, how they're bred, what the hatching process is, how nations try to counter each other and defend for the fact that the other one's got a Kaiju, and putting these Kaiju up against each other. There will be a volume 2 or a book 2. This one sits at just over 100 pages, I think, and it's full color. And I would direct you to worldwarkaiju.com or 01, not spelt out, just a zero character, 01publishing.com, and look at this book that you can pre-order there, or some of the other stuff they have that some of it looks interesting, and I may be checking it out and getting back to you guys. The creators are Josh and Kat Finney, and they also did the Utopiates several years ago in 2005. And I think it was black and white then, but they have a colorized collection of it now that I'm going to check out and see what's what there. But in the back, there's like faux ads, and there's an index of the different monsters and, you know, like little file dossiers on them and documents and little strips here and there. It's a cool package.
01 is a first second. They've done like Delilah Dirk and a bunch of other books. They tend to do a lot of odd sizes, but I thought it was odd that they're first second because there's First Publishing and there's a lot of other comic book printing companies with similar names. But yeah, First Second always does fun stuff.
Yeah, Delilah Dirk's
the only one I can remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, and they seem to have exposure beyond the direct market too, which is always good.
But it was interesting you were talking about the kind of the digital, because at the recent Long Beach Expo, I did go to the colorist panel. I liked the process panels, and they had David Barron and Beth Salito and a bunch of other colorists. And I asked them about that because now, you know, there's digital and there's print and there's all these different ways. And it was just that Barron had some well-thought-out points about the difference between it coming on the monitor, like you said, it comes, the light's through it, or on the page, it's reflecting down it, and you got to think about the different paper stock and things like that. And I always find that stuff, now that we're entering the age of the colorist, I had to go to the colorist panel. But it was interesting because I got in a bit of a fight about the value of school. Barron was big on going to college, and Beth and the other guy who does a lot of work for Aspen, he did the coloring for Brightest Day, whatever that one for DC is. But he's an Aspen guy. And they were both of like the, you know, school of learning on the job, and he was big on the art school. And so they rarely do you see panels kind of get into it where there's such a sharp divide in opinion. So that was a fun panel to go to for that, because, you know, that's the two sides. Do you learn, you know, do you just go to the job and get your education there, and do you get it from professors and that process,
or then you teach it to yourself?
Yes. Well, they were also remarking that the business had changed quite a bit.
Yeah,
a lot of them came up in the studio system at like Wildstorm, and I don't know that those kind of bullpens exist a lot anymore. I mean, it's one of the advantages of the computer, you know, everybody, you can get a guy in Brazil and one guy in Portland and one guy in Canada, and they can all just collaborate without being in a physical studio. Although the studios are still around, somewhat, I just don't think they're the same size. All right, let's go back to Canada.
I hear you have seven other comics to talk about, Phil.
Yes. This is another one I really love that two issues came out so far. And I don't know how you guys are missing these comics just because the covers are so nice. The Woods by Boom Studios.
I saw that on the shelf.
How would you skip that? Like, I don't understand.
It was sold out at my store.
Was it? I can see it being sold out for sure. Yeah,
yeah, so. I think there was a second printing of the first issue or something. But
yeah, got it. He said he'll have more in stock soon.
Yeah.
And he's always like, why don't you just go on my website and reserve what books you want, and I'm like, yeah, sounds like work.
This is an amazing story where basically it's a Lost, basically a story like Lost, where a group of people, where in this case it's a school of 400 kids and 62 teachers or whatever, they just end up on an alien planet all of a sudden.
This sounds like Drifting Classroom in a way.
Mind you, you don't know if it's an alien planet, but there's like three moons or something. Or
yeah.
They're on a moon.
Either they've had some good drugs or something.
Yeah, it's by James Tanion IV. I hate when people add the number at the end. So stupid. And Michael Dianis. I don't know who they are, but I really like their work. But yeah, so they're on.
Sorry, I believe Tinian's done a bunch of DC stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, isn't he like, I'm not, maybe I have this wrong, but like Snyder's protege or something like that?
Yeah, I think he's done some of that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I worked with him. And might be also some of the Lantern stuff now. There's so many books over there with that, I can't, I'm not going to pretend I can tell you which ones are still ongoing and what's being published. I mean, it's a great company and all the
back to the woods.
Yeah, so anyway, there's all these like weird creatures just killing them off and stuff, and they don't know what to do. Like, the teachers are all confused trying to figure stuff out, but they're gym teachers and science teachers. They can't really do anything. So some of the students kind of go on their own, a small group of them, into the woods. And so basically, yeah, so yeah, in the comic now with the second issue out too, basically it deals with the people still at the school and then the people going off in the woods on their own kind of adventure. But this is another must-get for me. The art's great. Story's great. It has lots of mysteries that you really want to figure out. And if you're a fan of Lost, it's great. I like those type of stories.
It's all about the journey sometimes.
Mm-hmm. The endings are never the best, but the mysteries are cool for a while.
Certainly spikes my interest because of the Lost thing. And then I had to bring up something Japanese, of course. So.
Of course.
Like the whole Drifting Classroom series, it's like a school went into like the future of Earth, so the Earth was like all like messed up, and then like their teachers started killing the kids and other stuff. Because of course it's Japanese, you know, they have to have some crazy stuff going on. But yeah, like it seems like that. Like that concept, except, you know, twisted in a different way, which I think would be appealing.
That's one you told me about before that I wanted to read, but I've never found it anywhere.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still in print from, I think it was Viz?
Yeah, it's hard to get the book sometimes.
Yeah, and it, especially since it's a mature series, you know, it's not stocked as heavily as some of the other stuff for a younger audience. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of a younger audience, what else you got, Kevin?
I guess this is for a younger audience. And I didn't realize I had two Mike Norton-related things. But I read The Answer from Dark Horse Comics by Mike Norton and Dennis Hopeless.
Is that a reprint of their web one they did for that app?
I don't know, because I don't think I've read anything like that in their app. Like, I read some of their other stuff, but I don't think I ever ran across The Answer. Because this is a four-issue story. So I'm thinking there might have been a prior adventure, but like this seems like its own thing.
Okay.
And I guess they haven't done any more, but I'd kind of be interested for another one, because it's sort of like, I guess this is like a Ditko-like character. Like, instead of the question, like, this is the answer, he has like a big exclamation point on his mask. And then like the typical, you know, superhero outfit, like boots, gloves, belt. And they don't really get into, really, who he is or what he does.
Like, does he team up with Mr. B and the creepster or whatever, if we're going on Ditko parodies?
Yeah. So this is he's just kind of, he kind of drifts in and out of the story, like helping, like, this woman that's a librarian and she's really smart. And he just sort of helps her along so that she doesn't, like, get screwed over by this weird conspiracy through the whole thing. And I'm like, well, I really want to know more about the title character. It's just kind of strange in that way. Like, he gets shot up and horrible things happen to him, and you're like, can he survive that? And then other characters are like, who knows? We don't know much about this guy, but he has a way of staying alive. And sure enough, he shows up again later on, and you're like, well, that's kind of strange. And he doesn't seem that concerned about, like, killing people or stuff like that, like, accidentally. So it's just rather weird. But yeah, the main story is...
Staying alive.
There we go. But yeah, the main story is about a librarian that's really smart, and she's like solves some things and goes to this website, and basically it's like a training ground. If you get through all the stuff on the website, you'll I guess attract the attention of other people who will come to see you, who might not be up to very nice things. But it also kind of reminds me of Morning Glories in a way, when she wakes up at like this facility where everyone else is sort of like, oh, this is an awesome place, but she doesn't think it's an awesome place, and then people are being drugged, and weird things are going on at this business, I guess. I don't know if you would really call it a business.
Nothing but, is like, as people, it seems.
Yeah, like things are, it's pretty weird. And people are working on stuff, and people seem happy. So that's, and there's always going to be like that one person who's like off their meds, or is like, oh, I'm going to be, something's going to happen to me soon, so let me fill you on the real deal. What's going on here? You got to remember this stuff. If you want to get out here get out of here alive. So things get to the eventual conclusion, but I'm like, there must be more stories. Like, I would like to see more stories, because there's a little bit of resolution, but it seems like there could be more going down here. It's a kind of a cool book.
Are you guys fans of Vampirella at all?
Sometimes. In theory.
Yes, theory? Okay, well,
I'll vote with the way Steve does.
We'll all vote that way.
When I was younger, remember when Vengeance of Vampirella came out?
Yes.
Well, I picked up the first issue and collected that as a kid, and it got me reading some of the older stuff. And I never liked her costume, just because, I don't know, I felt embarrassed reading, I guess, because I was young. But I loved those supernatural stories and just the adventures she'd have, like being stuck in an underground government agency with all these like demons and stuff, like really cool horror-type stories. But then after that, after Vengeance of Vampirella, it got really weird, like... she became Japanese for a while, like all these weird different versions of her.
Yep.
The last version by Dynamite, she was almost like a detective, I believe, kind of wearing pants and a different costume, which kind of is what I always wanted, but at the same time, it just didn't work. She needs her classic costume. So anyway, so a new number one came out because it's her 45th anniversary, and this one's written by a girl. Unless I'm mistaken and it's a guy's name too, but I don't think so. Nancy A. Collins. It's got to be a girl. And Patrick Birkin Cotter is the artist. And yeah, it feels like the Vampirella I always liked reading. She's kind of back to the basics. This writer seems to know the characters from her past and is going to pull things out of like the old Harris runs and stuff. There's a cult in here, which I swear is a cult I've read many times in a lot of the older stuff. And so it was cool seeing that. But she's back in old costume. She doesn't have her old pals. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but she had this old magician that followed her around. And then she was dating like this politician guy. But they seem out of the picture right now. I imagine they're going to show up at some point, but right now it just seems to be her.
Color or black and white, Phil?
Color.
Cool.
Yeah.
So she's from, in this one, she's from the other planet or
Dracula.
Fighting Dracula?
Or... All the old stuff counts. It's not a reboot or anything.
Well, all the old stuff can't count because they did different versions of
it. Well, not all the old stuff, but
the real
like
stuff.
More real stuff, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, for me to enjoy a good Vampirella story, it seems like I have to either have it really be super high quality art, or I have to have it be really super high quality art.
I don't know if it's super quality, because I guess I have lower standards than everyone else, but it's, I don't know, I think it's good art.
That Masters series that they put out a few years ago in a collection of trade paperbacks were great. They bunched either artists or writers together with a bunch of stories, and there was, you know, a bunch of stuff from like Gary Frank and all different creators, and Mark Teixeira, and that great way to get chunks of the post original Vampirella series when everything was, you know, black and white and done by the Filipino artists.
A lot of British people like Vampirella too. They'd worked on her a lot.
Cool.
Yeah.
Along the lines of a kick-ass heroine, I discovered via another one of these, you know, free number ones that I got through the digital service there from Comixology when they had that big bundle, was Killing Girl. Have you heard of this series from 2007 from Image?
Nope.
I've particularly heard of the artist because, the artist of the first two issues, I should say.
Yeah.
Because he worked on that great Rocketto series that I just loved.
Really?
So it was just like action-adventure, and it was sideways and everything. It was so good.
Okay, let me set this up a little bit, and then I need to ask you about that. Killing Girl was a 5-issue series, like I said, from Image. It definitely, not all-ages material. written by Glenn Brunswick, who also wrote Reality Check and Jersey Gods. And the first two issues were drawn by Frank Espinoza. Just loved his art and color. And issues 3, 4, and 5 were drawn by Toby Cypress, who was okay. Tried to be in the same vein as Espinoza, which I don't know is Cypress's regular wheelhouse or not. He had a little bit of those Herb Trimpe second version doing the, like, in the 90s with the funny thighs action going on. But the story by then was engaging enough that the first two issues you're just sucked in by the art majorly. And then by then the art certainly carries the story along, but by then you're hooked with the story. The guy, this Espinoza, the only other thing I know of that he did was this Rocketto thing, and I have never read any of it. It was from 2007. There's 2 volumes of it. I assume that's why he left this book to go do that he wrote and drew. He's so... It's almost like in a Darwin Cook family of, big brush strokes that you can... Big, thick ink brush strokes. But he's even more... impressionistic in some ways, like
he's pretty abstract. He doesn't always connect his lines. Like you can, right. your eyes are just sort of like filling in the rest of the drawing.
Like I sent you guys pictures of the girl in the stockings, and he draws like striped stockings just by drawing the horizontal curved lines, no actual leg lines at all. That kind of thing, really cool. And the way the colors splash down is neat. She's like a real kick-ass hit woman mob enforcer. And during a hit, she crosses this FBI agent who identifies her as a lookalike of his fiance. And she's his fiance's twin sister. They both thought the other was dead, separated as youths. She was raised by the mob. And she ends up meeting her sister. The mob learns of this, and then they come after her and set her up to kill the... FBI agent who's the fiance and all that, and she goes to do that and accidentally kills her own sister. So now we just have the hit woman and the FBI agent, and they are not really getting along, but coming to terms with each other, and both sort of on the run. It's tons of kills getting racked up. It's fucked up, man. it's a very interesting story, self-contained, and I wish there was more stuff that Espinoza did. When I looked up his name and saw the Rocketto thing, the concept didn't catch my eye, but you're saying it was good?
Oh, it was so good. Because,
all right.
Yeah, the world was blown up, and since it was like back to, what would that be, like 1800s, 1900s, or whatever, when they're still exploring the world, and these guys are like called mappers, and they're like seeking out the world, and there's all these weird creatures, and it's like a very like pulpy comic strip action adventure thing, like maybe like Prince Valiant or something. It's very good.
Cool. I think it was my birthday this past week. I'm going to treat myself to the 2 volumes of Rocketto then, because I really wanted to experience more of his art. But again, the Rocketto concept didn't jump out at me. But if you're saying it was it was good, I'm in.
Yeah, very Flash Gordon-y too. He also did work for Marvel for a few backup stories for when the Female Scorpion had that 5-issue miniseries, like. It's got to be, 10 years back now or something?
Really?
Yeah. So he did, like, a few, I'm going to say maybe 8 pagers in the back of some of those issues.
Cray.
Yeah. But not that much work, but really interesting. And then his choice of colors is always different than what you usually see.
Yeah, like oranges and yellows next to each other. Like, what's up with that?
Oh, and there's also real cool maps that he has of the world, too. Like, if you like, you know, your maps and your diagrams and your building floor plans, I remember some of those being in there, too, which was awesome.
You know I do. As a lover of Tolkien and Robert E. Howard. More, Phil, more.
Oh, okay. God, okay, here's quick ones. I'll do three in like 20 seconds. Sex Uh-oh. Criminals by Fraction. You've got to read this comic. There's glowing dicks. There's... You get every sex position explained, like weird ones. Let me see if I can find it in here. I picked up the dollar issue because I wanted to see if I wanted to pick up the trade, and I really want to get the trade now.
I think I have the first issue in Comixology.
Same.
Yeah, here. You really get your bang for your buck, it looks like, too. So I'm very excited to pick up that trade. Next is Nightbreed.
Pun intended.
Nightbreed, are you guys familiar with that movie by Clive Barker?
I know it exists, but I haven't seen it.
Oh, what's wrong with
It's a book, isn't it? I thought it was a book first.
Well, it was a movie for me first.
Okay.
But yeah, you're right. He writes everything first. It's all books first. But I'm a big fan of him anyway, his stuff. And this is the first Nightbreed comic in a long time. There were some old ones. I think it was Now that I'm out, which I don't think I don't think I really like them that much. But there's a version of this movie coming out called The Cabal Cut, where because Hollywood kind of took all the good stuff out that people have been waiting forever to see, and that's coming out soon. So I think that's why this comic was able to get its, like, plus with the Hellraiser being popular with Boom, it allowed this comic to come out too. And yeah, I really had a good, it's basically their past kind of thing. And my internet beeped out for a second.
There you go. He's there. Woo.
I don't know what happened.
When you were gone, I just mentioned that I vaguely remembered the Epic Comics tie-in.
Okay.
Ago. Those are the first comics back in 1990.
Yeah, that was it was like a Barker-verse, wasn't there? Where there was a bunch of Clive Barker titles through Epic.
But now it's Boom. As all
he
that.
Does in the Hellraiser. Man, those are good. So there's a new Hellraiser anthology coming out. I can't wait for. That's going to be something I'm excited for. Trees, I'm not going to talk about because I want to wait for you guys because I think Andrew might try and find it.
Yeah, I'll definitely get a copy of it. I just couldn't in the little window we had to pick it up. I sort of passed on it at Long Beach because I was giving someone a bunch of stick about it.
I think they still have 7,000 copies, or they did, for retailers to order. So,
yeah, my guy said he's getting more in the store. But if we're going to do sort of horror-ish titles, I got one, a quick one for you guys. I know I seeded my first round to Phil, but I got greedy again. issue 0 of Hellbillies from our friends at Kingbone Press. This is a... Brian Bowles and John Westhoff, and they also have coloring by Sean Fagan. And this is basically Brian Bowles, some of you may know, did a lot of the artwork for World's Strongest Mailman. Not all the arcs, but probably the most of it, if I had to guess, off the top of my head. And so that should give you a feel for what the artwork looks like. And here it's basically, imagine a rural Tennessee family that's like monster hunters. And this reporter, this girl from the big city, comes down to try and get an expose. And it turns out that that's when she finds out they're fighting. And so they end up taking on a manticore. For those of you of D&D persuasion may remember, it's the lion head giant monster with the scorpion tail and everything. But the setting is these... You know, they have big beards and overalls and things like that. So the sentiment is well struck. The artist lives in Tennessee. So I think he's drawing upon his ancestral home to channel these. But I like the sort of almost Lovecraftian, but in a way that puts a smile on my face. Like, it's horror, but it's the personality of these characters keep it from getting too overwhelmingly bleak. There's no references to the sort of things that Lovecraft always had of gibbering madmen and things like that. Mm-hmm. They keep this a bit lighter. But I really like it. But that's Hellbillies number 0 from Kingbone Press. And hopefully we'll see more from this series.
Nice. Friends of the show all.
Yes. Phil, you still have another one?
No.
No?
Shot is wad.
Well, I do, but I'm going to save
him. Oh.
Yeah. You could say we got our Phil.
Oh, wow. How do we come back from that?
The sounds of iPods turning off.
Hey, Andrew, want to wait until the end of the first arc of your guy, your pal and mine, but really your pals, Fred Van Lente's new Conan run?
Yeah.
You're going to read it, right? Because it's...
Sure. I've got the Brain Boy and a bunch of the other stuff. And I did pick up the limited edition Action Presidents Dead Tree Edition at Emerald City. So, yeah, I'm always a fan for what the boys are doing.
And I'll just pass along to everybody that you should be picking this book up. The new Conan the Avenger series, Fred Van Lente and Brian Ching. It's the post-Baelit death of the Queen of the Black Coast world. And if you weren't digging the Brian Wood run, this is different.
How could you not be digging that? I'm reading Volume 14, The Death of... right now.
Yeah, compared to... compared to the Marvel ones of Roy and Big John and Ernie Chan, I think the storytelling is so much more clearer and better paced and stuff in those old tales, and so much more going on and so much more characterization. This hesitant, emo, thin, gauntly drawn, no shoulders, weird... how his shoulder blades, it's like he's turtling his head all the time. It's not a typical presentation of Conan, I'll say.
No, and it's awesome if you don't think it's Conan, but yeah, as Conan, it's good.
And there's people who love it. That's fine. Some of the art has been really good, too. I like some of the earliest stuff.
The Becky Cloonan stuff is gorgeous. Yeah,
exactly. But she didn't stay on the book.
Yeah.
I like the way that Baelit died the real way.
Well, I'm always behind on Conan because I always get the nice hardcovers. Sure. And I have, 15, 16 volumes on the shelf now. So it's like, yeah, I'm used to being, like, way behind all the time.
Me too. I have a few Conans now saved up.
Well, start with Conan the Avenger so that we can read this arc and talk about it when it's done. It is a unfinished Robert E. Howard tale that Roy and Big John did adapt in the regular Conan the Barbarian series from Marvel back in 106 and 107. It's in the Dark Horse Volume 13, Chronicles of Conan, their recolored reprinting stuff. And it's The Shadows Over Kush, which is a much nicer name for the original title, which was The Snout in the Dark.
Yeah.
You're going to get the pig man.
I've not seen those Dark Horse recolored jobs. How does that compare to the...
It's great. It's great. Yeah. I'm a lover of the flat color too, but I've enjoyed rereading all those old Conan stories all again with the modern coloring. It's awesome. What it didn't work on was Frank Thorne's Red Sonja stuff. When they reprinted and tried to recolor that, didn't work. That needed the flat color.
Dynamite try to do some of that?
They did. Yeah, had the license. They actually republished. I have two volume ones that are like 8 months apart because they redid the coloring again because it was a mess. Hot mess. But yes, the Chronicles of Conan are safe. Those are really good.
So many of them, though.
Yeah, well, they're up to the post-Roy Thomas stuff now, into the Jim Owsley, Christopher Priest-written stuff, and some of the other stuff.
I just only recently found out, probably in the last year, that he just did change his name.
Oh.
What? Like, I didn't know that was the same
dude.
So
hilarious.
I was like, wow. Well, that's the fun thing about... Well, I guess he wasn't working under a pseudonym like the good old days, but...
One more, guys, or...
I wanted to see Phil talk about some Valiant, but I guess...
Well, I got some Valiant. I got XM9. All right,
go for it.
Well, Kevin, you lead, because this is something you know.
What, XO?
Yeah, I read the first trade.
The first trade.
Yeah. I bought two, but this first trade I loved, but I'm not excited for anything else that comes after.
I think the second trade is my favorite XO story of the modern stuff. I don't know. I guess something with the whole ninjack and the second one that's like a ninja and he's like a Union Jack. Something about that. I was just like, it's so cool. And then they go fight aliens.
For me, the thing is the first four issues that are in this first trade, for one thing, that's weak for all their trades are four issues. That's such a jip.
And that's how they bring it in under $10, though.
Shut up. And basically, yeah, this four issues, they're stuck. Like, they're from the past, and they get stuck on this alien, slave ship or whatever. And it's really, really cool. He doesn't get the suit till near the end. But then at the end, he lands on Earth, so it's going to be more mixed with... Now he's in our time and on Earth. So I'm just not as excited. I really enjoyed him without the powers, like, being a slave on this alien world or whatever.
Yeah, really I know... Yeah, I know there was some criticism of that because they wanted to see him, like, suited up in the first issue rather than...
I like that they didn't.
Yeah. Like, I can see each viewpoint, but considering what they did in the original, I could see the writer saying, yeah, I want to really explore this and seed future stories in those early issues before he gets to Earth.
I kind of wish they picked different colors for his costume, though. I don't think the classic colors really work anymore. The blue and gold. But, yeah, the first trade's really worth picking up. After that, Kevin says it's good, but I don't
know. Yeah. And if you don't want to pick up the trade, they have nice oversized hardcovers that covers the
I wish I waited for that.
Yeah, I think it's... I'm going to say 12. Three arcs?
It's 12,
It might be a little more than that.
12 issues?
It might be 13.
Nope.
I'm not sure.
Well, I'm sure.
You sure? All right, as long as you're sure.
Nice.
But I think it ramps up pretty well and sets everything up. And you got to kind of... Since it's sci-fi, there's like weird time distortion, dilation stuff going on. So you got to sort of take that into account.
I feel like I missed my chance to jump into Valiant, though. I've waited too long. And there's just too much out now, and because it all goes together too much.
I don't think so. That's like saying you can't jump into Marvel because you know you missed on the stuff in the '60s.
Valiant's different because it's this little contained universe, like Invincible. You can't just jump into Invincible.
I'm sure you could.
You could still do like Archer and Armstrong. They did have a crossover, but it's pretty self-contained story.
And they're. Their whole point of their Valiant First promotion right now is, like, you could jump into stuff. It's like Rye. Like, you could jump into the first
But it's my collector problem. Mentality. I need it all if I'm going to read it.
Well, that's going to really hurt you for other companies.
That's why I can't read it.
That's crazy.
Like, it's too late. I wish I jumped on at the start, but I didn't. I was too slow.
But you could get all the Archer and Armstrong pretty easily.
Well,
that's all 80 issues.
That and Quantum Woody I will get on their own, but anything else, I won't.
I don't know.
And if you like them and enjoy them, that may lead to more stuff, but just take it one title at a time.
Yeah, like, there's references between them, but they're all pretty much self-contained, unless there's, like, a couple crossovers here and there.
Hmm. I don't agree.
You don't agree?
No.
And that, folks, was the last episode. No.
Yeah, we're not going to be... I need special rules for this podcast now. Phil can't talk about certain things. He has to come in later on after my bid is done. And
Andrew, you hear how they do things up there?
I'm still mad at Andrew because he gave me Super Pro.
What?
We still have a feud going on for that.
You don't like American football?
Not anymore.
And you still haven't talked about Lovecraft.
I know. It's true. We got to talk about that.
We're two comics in that package.
Actually, I liked the backup in that.
All right, gang. Let's wrap this up. You can leave us an iTunes review. Come join us on our Facebook page. Listen to our sister show, Marvel Noise. Follow us on Twitter. Come back next time.
Still wrong. Phil's wrong.
Act your age. Go read some indie comics.
Later.
Sweet surrender. Yeah, you remember we used to run high. In the shadow of a car, was to take you home.